The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Derek Dorch of the Diversa Group, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and careers. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dorch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch from Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thank you for stopping by the show. Today we're going to be talking about defense budgets. A new report kind of came out that talked about the dynamics of the seven areas to watch in the 2017 defense budget. Catherine Blakely from the Center of Strategic and Budgetary Assessments produced this report, and it's been getting some traction, and people have been talking about this. People have been wondering what's going on in terms of the future of defense budgets, you know, going up, going down, what programs will be cut, and everything else. Catherine's a research fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment, and we're glad to have her on the show. Catherine, welcome to Fed Access.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Hey, you know, this report, I mean, one, you know, Catherine, what was the rationale on your report in terms of the seven areas to watch in the 2017 defense budget? What were you thinking about when you produced this?
Well, the defense budget obviously is a huge chunk of our federal spending, but it's very complicated. You're looking at the budgets not only for the Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, Army, also defense-wide. So there's really a lot to kind of shift through. And this report was an effort to prioritize and focus certain aspects of it to make it a little bit more understandable to the lay audience.
You know, as we begin looking at it, I mean, what have you seen over the past few years in terms of defense budgets? Have you seen, you know, before we kind of even dive directly into your report, what have you seen as the trends in terms of, you know, the past several years of this administration and everything else? Increases, decreases? I mean, I know everybody has been talking about cyber a lot. Terrorism has been on people's minds. But what have you seen overall?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the two biggest contextual things to keep in mind are, one, the shift from when the Obama administration entered office between the two ground wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the drawdown of those wars, the shift into a more of a focus on a high-tech, high-end capabilities, and two, the constraint that has been put in place from the 2011 Budget Control Act and the limitations that that has imposed on both defense and non-defense federal spending. Those are the two major contextual things that have really shaped the defense budget since then. So from, say, 2008, we have a quite high peak of defense spending, higher than almost all of the Reagan years when you put it into inflation-adjusted context. Since then, we've seen a decline in defense spending, a decline in you know, the number of ground forces, but within that decline, and a lot of that was, again, motivated by the 2011 Budget Control Act, you've seen a shift in emphasis also away from ground forces, and in recent years, the last two or three years especially, a renewed focus on a potential high-end adversary.
You know, when you talk about a high-end adversary, are we talking about kind of a state actor? Are we talking about kind of a Russia or a North Korea scenario? Or are we talking about the high-end adversary as it relates to a more kind of mobile adversary like a terrorist organization like ISIS? I mean, when we look at that, what is that, you know, really defined as?
Yeah, so looking at the recent budget release on Tuesday, the five key threats that were outlined, and this is not in any sort of strategic order, potential threats include Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and transnational terrorist networks. And certainly not all of them are going to be as strong as each other. They're not going to have the same kinds of challenges from each potential adversary. But there are things that overlap, like, for example, the ability of transnational terrorist networks to exploit much better intelligence and reconnaissance capabilities than they had previously possessed. So you see certain aspects of that across several potential challenges.
You know, with all of this kind of in the dynamic, you know, are you seeing anything in terms of the cyber, or cyber is kind of being put in with all of this stuff in terms of kind of, I mean, because, you know, we talk about kind of cyber terrorism. We saw Russia kind of use, you know, different information operations, maybe possible cyber attacks in Ukraine situation, electronic warfare. Is that kind of being merged into, you know, these high-end adversary threats, or is that a separate dynamic?
It's certainly a very strong increased area of focus. I mean, if you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, those are not really situations or engagements where cyber plays a central role. Obviously, you have issues with trying to suppress or jam IEDs. They don't have that same kind of full spectrum concern about cyber. And so now looking forward into what kind of capacities that we may need in the future, there's a much greater emphasis on cyber generally. There's a greater growing emphasis, although not as robust, on electronic warfare. That's still an area where people are kind of catching up to speed a little bit, as well as greater emphasis on the cyber capabilities of our platforms to integrate the information from the sensing systems, from the sensors, from the ISR capabilities, and integrate that into the actual weapon systems and platforms to improve not only the resilience of our ability to talk to each other, but to have an understanding of what's going on out there in whatever engagement we may find ourselves in the future.
You know, as we begin thinking about this and kind of looking towards the future of these kind of future threats and other areas, you know, some people will say that, you know, the defense spending kind of going down, of course, it increased while we were in the war footing areas, right? You know, after 9/11, you know, 2003 and other areas, you know, while we were in Afghanistan and Iraq, those in significant increases. But some people will argue that the decreases of spending have now made our nation weaker, especially when they hear about spending with China has increased in other areas in terms of military. I mean, what's the thoughts on that? I mean, as you look at the numbers, and of course, you're kind of looking at it from an unbiased scenario, but is it a weakening of the force or is it just a reprioritization of the force?
Yeah, I tend to think it's more of a reprioritization of the force. Obviously, your total spending isn't as important as focusing the investments and the resources that you do have on the right capabilities at the right time. And that's why it's a very difficult proposition for the Secretary of Defense and the budgeteers in the department to come through and say, okay, given the resources that have been allocated to us by Congress through the BCA Act of 2011, and it's amendments after that date, here is what we think are the most important priority areas of investment and areas of focus.
You know, as we begin thinking about this and going forward, you know, of course, this is the last year of the Obama administration in terms of the political fight, because you kind of go into that in the beginning of your report, right? That's what we've always been dealing with, the political fight that's going on. What are we seeing, you know, in terms of the executive branch versus kind of our legislative branch, our congressional officials? Are they really fighting about what the priorities are and how much spending it is? And, you know, do we, you know, think that we may see, depending if there's administration change, you know, whether it be a Republican administration, will some of the changes that the Obama administration in terms of priorities, will they change? And if it's a Democrat administration, of course, you know, some of these things may stay the same. What are we seeing as we go into 2017? I mean, I know it's hard to predict that, but, you know, from kind of past dynamics, what we've seen with Bush and then Obama and then maybe going forward, what can we possibly anticipate?
Yeah, well, that's a big set of questions, Derek. So let me break that down a little bit. Of course, the overall level of defense spending is a very salient issue, as we've all seen recently in the presidential nomination contest, particularly on the Republican side, where it tends to be used as a proxy for our military strength. It's a little bit easier to talk about what the overall dollar numbers are and use that as a very simple yardstick, rather than unpacking that and saying, okay, so what actually are we buying in terms of capabilities? So on the congressional side, though, in this year's budget, you have, a reprise or rehashing of the debate that happened last year about whether our defense needs are being adequately funded and whether it's appropriate to add additional money for defense through this workaround to the Budget Control Act through the Overseas Contingency Operations funding stream. So like last year, many of the more defense hawk Republicans are pushing to add more money through this OCO account, where that really gets the department out of the constraints that were imposed by the Budget Control Act of 2011. On the other hand, on the Democratic side, they're saying, look, you know, we do have these defense needs, but we also have these non-defense needs, which are also constrained by the BCA cap, which puts an equal limit on both defense and non-defense. Why should we give defense extra money without also giving non-defense extra money? And so last year you had a very protracted political fight. You had a veto threat and then an actual veto of the defense bill, which did give more money to defense without doing anything for non-defense by President Obama. And this year it seems like we're shaping up for a similar a similar structured argument, even though the budget deal of last October could put the department at least on a stable level for this year, even if it's one that, particularly in the Republican side of Congress, they think is too low. So once again, you see Representative Thornberry saying that, hang on a second, we thought the level of OCA we agreed to was a floor. We expected you to put the things that you wanted to buy that you can't afford under the BCA caps in the regular budget into OCA, and then you have the administration saying, no, we need to comply with the BCA caps. We are not going to just shift everything wholesale into OCA and make an argument there about how it's a pretty unstable funding stream and you don't want to put things you're going to need for a long time in money that's only reliably around for 1 year.
Catherine, we got to take a quick break. I want to get in because you just mentioned a whole bunch of different things that I want to kind of break down and help our listeners understand with the OCO and the BCA and the Budget Control Act, because there's a lot of good information in order to kind of figure out about discretionary spending and, you know, where are we going forward with this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. We're talking to Catherine Blakely. She is a research fellow at the Center for Strategic Budget and Budgetary Assessment. You can find them if you Google them. They'll be on, what's the website, Catherine, so they can know the website real quick?
It's csbaonline.org.
csbaonline.org. You can find what we're talking about on their website. It's a report that we're talking about, which talks about the seven areas to watch in the 2000 or the FY17 defense budget. We'll be right back after this break. We're going to keep this conversation going. Listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch from Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch from Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been talking about the defense budget. Always a good topic. I mean, because we always spend a lot of money on defense and people wonder, where is this money going to? But we're talking about a special report that just came out, the seven areas to watch in the FY17 defense budget. Where are things going in 2017? We're going to have a new president in that dynamic. We're going to also be looking at maybe some new priorities. And also we want to know, where are the defense dollars going with new administrations and anything like that, whether it be Democratic or Republican? We want to know where that money is going. We're talking to Catherine Blakely. She's a research fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment. You can find them online at csbaonline.org. And you can also find this report. I think it's on the front page right now, but you can find this report, read it. A lot of good information and a lot of good kind of charts to digest and everything else to really kind of see what's going on in terms of defense dollars. Catherine, you know, you were mentioning a couple of different things. You're talking about the overseas contingency operations. You were also talking about the Budget Control Act and where those things go. Let me even kind of back it up a little bit for people to understand. When we talk about kind of the BCA, the Budget Control Act, how does that impact? What is that first? And then how does that impact defense dollars?
Of course, Derek. So the Budget Control Act in 2011 was an agreement in Congress, it's a law in Congress, that set limits on federal discretionary spending. And those, so you have a certain pool of money that you're allowed to spend, and you can't go over that. And half of that was set aside for defense, and half of that is set aside for non-defense, things like education, things like Department of Housing and Urban Development, everything else that the federal government does. So since 2011, you have had in law these limits that neither the defense side nor the non-defense side can go up. Now, that was really motivated a lot by the concerns over the federal deficit that were very, very strong in 2011. Since then, with the recovery from the economic recession, with a somewhat greater optimism, a little bit more economic vitality, and a little bit less concern about the deficit, those caps have been relaxed somewhat. But because it's a legislative cap, any increases in those also have to go through Congress and also have to be enacted into law. And so you've had a series of 1 or 2 year deals that have given the defense and the non-defense spending pools a little bit of a bump up, a little bit of an increase. And we just had that most recently in October of this year, which gave a little bit of, they call it sequester relief, for both defense and the rest of the federal government spending equally in fiscal 16 and then now in fiscal 17, which we're planning for now, which of course starts in October.
Right. You know, when we think about this and now with these budget control limits and everything else, and maybe some things being lifted because of better economy and all the other kind of pieces, you also mentioned about the overseas contingency operations, which is really that discretionary spending dollars for the Pentagon. What is that right there? And how much discretion is that to run operations?
Yeah, so the overseas contingency operations is how we have paid for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was originally set up that only the new costs of those wars were allowed to be included. Over time, it's gotten a little bit more flexible, some might say a little exploited. And the reason this is salient in terms of the budget and the budget caps is because the money that is funneled through the OCO, the Overseas Contingency Operations, or OCO, budget portion, is not actually subject to these caps. So it is a way... it's designed to be a way to fund urgent operational needs. The risk is that that becomes your piggy bank to pay for important defense needs going forward. Because again, defense side of the house has this OCO workaround if it's very important. The non-defense side of the house does not have that safety valve.
You know, with all of that, you know, in terms of that discretionary dollar, I mean, what have you seen in terms of the fight as it relates to the Pentagon and everything else? I mean, as the Pentagon and the defense and the, you know, the Secretary of Defense and the generals there, are they asking for more discretionary funding? I mean, are they saying, hey, listen, we don't mind the, you know, because we, you know, don't have as many troops in Afghanistan and Iraq and we are kind of changing priorities. What are you seeing in terms of their requests? You know, is it a fight for more money? I mean, of course, they want more money, but are they really battling it, or they're like, you know what, this is okay?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like any federal agency, if you hand them more dollars, they'll find a good way to spend it.
Right.
and I do want to emphasize here that the leadership in the Department of Defense obviously is under the authority of the Commander-in-Chief, President Obama, so you're not going to have people going completely off the reservation and saying, you know, we need twice as much money. What the department has been doing is saying, look, we can meet these spending levels, but then here's the capabilities and here's the manpower and here's the resources we're going to be able to buy, and here's the things we're not going to be able to buy. Of note, for this year, the Defense Department submits this budget for each year, but they also submit kind of a plan for the 4 years after that, so you can see how it connects to the bigger picture, because obviously a lot of these programs take a really long time to buy. Think of an aircraft carrier. You don't just finish that in the shipyard within a couple months. It takes a long time to build it.
Sure.
So over the next 4 years, they're saying we'd like to buy about $100 to $105 billion more than the budget caps, which we just talked about, are going to allow us to do.
You know, when we look at it, I mean, you mentioned that's kind of the dynamic. And let me even ask before we go on to part two about finding $22 billion that, you know, of course, as we lower the numbers, there's $22 billion that seems to be asked for, and even a little bit more that's being asked for. That's, okay, where is this at? Or we got to draw down, you know, maybe spending on these other areas. But in terms of the political fight, where do you see that going? I mean, of course, there's going to be elections. There may be a couple changes in terms of who runs the House or who runs the Senate and things like that. Do you see, you know, the political fight continuing in terms of defense budget, or are people starting to get on the same page as it relates to where spending should be going?
Yeah, you've seen definitely a narrowing of the spectrum of opinions about defense funding. The budget resolution in Congress last year for fiscal 16 spending was, I think, only $1 billion more than President Obama's budget plan that year. So that's a very, very, very close level when you consider that it's about a $580 billion budget. Mm-hmm. You're not even 0.5% off. So I think there has been a growing consensus opinion about where the defense budget should be. But on the political side of things, you do have, of course, attention in the Republican Party, and you see this in the House of Representatives most strongly, between the defense hawks who want to strongly to increase defense spending. And the fiscal hawks are saying, you know, we still have this long-term deficit picture. And so you see that tension playing out, particularly on the House side in Congress.
You know, with all of this, I mean, kind of going into, and I mean, we see these reductions of numbers, and you really kind of went into a couple different areas of, you know, finding, you know, money or finding areas of reduction. I want to talk about first in terms of military personnel. A lot of the branches, you know, and I served in the Marine Corps. And so, I mean, of course, you know, I pay attention to all the numbers, and I saw the drawdown of the Marines, you know, the drawdown of the Army, the drawdown of certain services from, you know, peaks. You know, Marine Corps was in peaks of over 200 something thousand, now drawing it down to 188 or 183 or whatever that number was, you know, in terms of the actual number in which it was, you know, going to be. What are we seeing? Is that going to continue to be the case, that we're going to draw down the number of people that we have in the service branches in order to continue to reduce these numbers? Or where is that standing in terms of military personnel?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And let me just clarify one thing before we move into it. That $22 billion, that's the difference between what the plan had been last year for okay. this year's spending, and then the money that's actually going to be available.
Okay.
So it's not a cut. It's actually a slight increase from the money that Congress appropriated last year, but it's still a gap between what the department had hoped to have and what they are actually going to have this year.
And so they basically got to find money, I mean, in order to basically fund these additional programs.
Yeah. I mean, it's like if you're doing your household budget and you don't get that raise you were hoping for, if you've already kind of planned how to spend it, you've got to relook at your plans.
Right. Sure. And so where in terms of military personnel are we thinking about kind of looking at those numbers?
Yeah. And so to your question about end strength, which is how we often term the number of people in the Army, the Marine Corps, the Air Force, and the Navy, to remember, we have already seen a drawdown in the defense budget. We've already seen a shift in emphasis from the ground wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so we already have had, I think, nearly all of the reductions in the number of people in the Army, the number of sailors in the Navy, the number of airmen in the Air Force that we're going to have. You know, we've come down from a peak of about 570,000 people in the active duty Army to now we're very close to that final number of 450,000. And really, I think we're very near the floors here. That's partly because we do still need a certain number of people to be ready for the missions that we may have to face. And it's also because, you know, we've already moved fairly far along this path.
You know, with all of that, in terms of, you know, the end strength, and we've seen certain things happen. We've seen kind of the terrorist incidents happen overseas in Paris and other areas. Recently, the DIA, you know, a director said, you know, we plan to see more attacks that are happening. General Stewart was talking about more attacks. There was a period of time, there was a focus of increasing, you know, special forces, right? You know, increasing Navy SEALs and Rangers and MARSOC and all the other kind of pieces. Mm-hmm. I know there's a kind of a drawdown in some areas, but are we going to continue to see the increase in terms of kind of more specialized operations in this kind of budget going to 2017?
Yeah, in terms of special forces, I think we're going to see maybe a slight increase, but largely holding steady.
Okay.
And that's partly because you're drawing your special forces from your pool of regular active duty service members. You know, so you can't increase special forces much more than the pool of people you have to support that.
Sure. So you're probably going to have just necessary more kind of pulling of the regular forces and seeing who's qualified to be in those, but not necessarily increases in terms of the numbers of those people as we go forward. Is that what you're thinking?
I think you've seen definitely a commitment to protecting the number of special forces. We do rely a lot on our special forces operators, mm-hmm. particularly in these irregular theaters. And so I don't think you're going to see really reductions in those numbers.
Sure. We're talking to Catherine Blakely. Let me make sure I got that right, Catherine, because you're about to correct me. We're talking to Catherine Blakely. She is the research fellow at the Center for Strategic Studies, Strategic and Budgetary Assessment. Catherine, what am I talking about? The Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment.
You know, if nobody stumbled over an acronym, it wouldn't be Washington.
That's right. It wouldn't be Washington. And so now people know that I'm actually human. But we're talking to Catherine Blakely. She's a research fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment. You can find their website at csbaonline.org, csbaonline.org. We are talking about her recent report that talks about the seven areas to watch in the 2017. And on the report, it says FY17 defense budget, really trying to understand what's going on as we go into, you know, 2017. Where's the money going in terms of defense spending? And then also, how are we dealing with the political dynamics as it relates to defense spending as we go forward? We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been talking about defense spending, defense budget. We're talking about 2017. We're talking about what are the dollars going to look like? What are going to be the areas of prioritization as we go into the FY17 budget? We're talking about a recent report that just came out from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment, and it's the seven areas to watch in the FY17 defense budget, the 2017 defense budget. We have the author of this report, Catherine Blakely. She's a research fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment, and she's breaking down these different areas and in terms of prioritization of where defense dollars are going and these different seven areas for us to watch. You know, Catherine, when we look at, you know, we talked about military personnel, but, you know, the big baby in the room and is really kind of those big programs, right? The fighter programs, the ship programs, and all the, you know, missile programs and everything else. When we look at that kind of stuff, and also when we look at research and development, right, and we look at all those other kind of pieces, what are we seeing in terms of defense dollars across the board with the spending? Are we seeing reductions in terms of the number of things being asked for because it's too expensive? Like you mentioned about carriers, it takes time to get these things going. It takes time to do research. What are we looking at?
Yeah. So as I talked about a little while ago, the last couple budget cycles, we saw a somewhat reduction in personnel. We saw some of a reduction in readiness, and so you see that reflected in what the budgets had been. This year, we're seeing a little bit more of a hit to procurement dollars, and that's where your actual purchasing of these big platforms and systems lives, is in the procurement accounts. So this year, we're looking at just over $100 billion in the base budget for procurement. The thing, one of the things that people don't really realize about the defense budget is that they think most of it is buying weapon systems and platforms and missiles and ships and aircraft and everything like that. But it actually is just under 20% of the defense budget.
So many people think that really all these dollars, I mean, you know, are going to these big, gigantic platforms. But where is the majority going? When you kind of look at it, if it's only 20%, where is that other 80% going?
Yeah, just under half of the defense budget is actually military personnel and civilian employees of the department.
Okay.
And then that 20% of it is actual procurement. A little bit less than 20% of it is also RDT&E, that's research, development, test, and evaluation. And so together, that with procurement is considered our modernization budget, the things that get us a new technology, that bring it through the research and development phase, that put it into a prototype, that test it, see what it's useful for, and then move it into the procurement side where you actually start buying it for use.
You know, you had a couple areas on here in terms of the top acquisition programs going into 2016 as we look at certain things, you know, really kind of looking at, you know, the MH-60, the CH-47, you know, helicopter, airplane, Trident II, you know, missile dynamics. What are we seeing with these top 20? I mean, in terms of overall prioritization, I mean, what would we classify it as? Is it, you know, aviation missiles and whatever the case is? I mean, what would you see that, hey, right now spending is here, and then also in 2017, will we continue to see either increases or just stabilized spending on these kind of programs?
Yeah, in fiscal 17, because you're taking this $11 billion cut to your procurement accounts, you're really forcing some difficult trade-offs between systems, particularly within the services. So, for example, the Air Force has made the decision to prioritize and protect the KC-46 tanker procurement, as well as the future long-range strike bomber, which that's mostly, most of the money is still in research and development, but it's still a very significant amount of dollars. And so they've had to push back the purchases of their version of the F-35. Instead of buying 48 this year, they're going to buy 43. Instead of buying 60 next year, they're going to buy maybe 45. And they're basically having to trim the F-35 in order to keep enough money to pay for the things they've decided are absolutely essential right now.
You know, with all of that, I mean, a lot of the spending in terms of maybe cutting back, some people will say, well, if you've got to cut back on either the number of fighters, you've got to cut back on the number of ships, then that's going to affect the capability, right, of the U.S. forces. And also it will, you know, affect our defense projection amongst, you know, other, you know, these high yield kind of threats in terms of China, Russia, you know, Iran and other things like that. You know, what in terms of the budget, as you look at it and then look at it in comparison to other nations and other areas, you know, do you think that our, you know, maybe adversaries or other people are going to see, oh, these reductions are going to, you know, reduce the capability of the United States?
Yeah, I'm glad you touched on capability, because this budget is really illustrating the tension between capability, which is, you know, the what can the system actually do, and then the capacity, which is how much presence can we have? How many ships do we have? How many planes do we have? And in the fiscal 17 budget submission, the Department of Defense has really emphasized the capability. So you see more investment in the higher end systems. You still have a strong investment in the F-35 by the Navy and the Marine Corps. You have a prioritization of the Ohio class replacement for the ballistic missile submarine. You have an improvement in the payload capacity of your Virginia class attack submarine at the expense of the ship numbers of the littoral combat ship, which is less of a high end surface vessel. So you have really a bet that we need to improve the high-end capabilities, and we can do without some of the presence, some of the capacity. Based on the past several years, I think that many in Congress are going to have somewhat of a different view. The number of ships in the fleet has been a hot issue in Congress, and the idea of that presence is sufficient, and that's where you see a lot of the contours of the debate emerging now.
Has there been, and just, you know, this is, you know, kind of going even beyond your report, but has there been a dynamic where, you know, the reductions and, you know, we've retired ships and we've done certain things, and also, you know, I mean, we always have this kind of presence all over the world and everything else, but has there been any kind of dynamic where it's been reported that because of these budget cuts, you know, our forces have not been able to accomplish certain things, and now it's riding into the new debate of 2017?
Yeah, I think you do see some elements of this capacity versus capability debate surfacing in the political world. You hear, for example, people talking about our carrier rotational presence in the Pacific and the Middle East. And for that kind of discussion, you really have to ask yourself, what are we doing with our armed forces? Are we just trying to physically be there? Is that our goal? Is that sufficient for the missions we're trying to achieve? Mm-hmm. Or do we need to worry about more the capabilities of the force to project power in a contested environment,
right,
to be able to maintain the linkages between our various weapon systems in a battle networks environment. And that's really somewhat of a philosophical debate, particularly as the tendency is to protect the force structure we already have and to protect a lot of the operational concepts and numbers we already have, rather than betting on these future developments and these this investment in more of the high-tech, high-end capabilities.
Right. You know, as we look at it, you know, there was a time period, you know, 2005 and other areas where we also saw the BRAC, right, the base realignment and closure dynamics. You know, as we look at these future budgets, I mean, is there also conversations that, you know, we need to go through? And, you know, there have always been conversations that we may need to go through another BRAC. But are you hearing rumblings in the halls of power and the halls of Congress that we may need to look at this again, you know, in terms of kind of, you know, the reprioritization of our forces?
Really, the battle lines around BRAC have been very clearly drawn and also very stable for the last 5 years.
Okay.
I think in every budget, the Department of Defense has asked to do a BRAC, and every year Congress has flatly rejected that. There are a few in Congress who really are supportive of the idea of taking another look at what bases and facilities the Department of Defense has. Can we consolidate? Can we do things more efficiently? In particular, Representative Smith, who is the ranking member of HASC, of the House Armed Services Committee, has been an advocate of looking at BRAC. But on a whole, it has been going nowhere in Congress. And especially as this is the last budget before a new president takes office, I would be very skeptical indeed that a BRAC round would get any traction. particularly because you need to spend some money up front to do the planning, to transition these bases, to make sure that there is an economic enough economic vitality in the community to absorb the closing of the base and transition it into another economic footing. So it's an upfront cost for long-term savings, which particularly when money is tight is a very difficult sell.
And really at this point in time, as maybe the economy is kind of coming back and things like that, no one wants to really, you know, basically take a base, and no congressional official wants to really have that kind of conversation about taking a base and closing it in their area.
Yep. Nobody wants to close anything in their district or their state, whether it's a base or a production line or anything.
You know, as we look at this kind of dynamic in terms of defense spending, you know, there's always defense contracting apparatus, right? You know, the people who build these, you know, systems, you know, that's always the Lockheeds and all the others, you know, as it relates to that kind of, you know, spending, you know, with these, you know, I mean, and there has been certain situations where some of these defense contractors have, you know, either lost contracts or they said we're going to give it to the middle-sized contracts or small businesses are going to be. Are there any kind of benefactors, you know, of this spending? You know, are we going to see more small businesses be, factors of this? Are we going to see more medium-sized or will it continue to stay with the bigger guys?
Yeah, I mean, there are already pretty strong incentives to either give contracts to or to have the biggest defense companies subcontract with small businesses, minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses, veterans-owned businesses, and that's built pretty deeply into the acquisitions regulation. Something that I want to highlight that I think is really promising is a lot of the contracts that the department does are not actually for weapon systems. It's for services. It's for things like accounting. It's for things like lawn mowing. It's for things like facilities maintenance. And this has kind of been a shift from historically buying things and then having people in the department do the services. And so now you have new contracting guidance, which is going to help the Department of Defense get better taxpayer value out of these services contracts.
We're talking to Catherine Blakely. She is a research fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment. You can find them at csbaonline.org. We're talking about her report, The Seven Areas to Watch in the FY17 Defense Budget. A great report in terms of really kind of getting an understanding of where things are going for 2017 in terms of the prioritization of the dollars that are being spent in terms of defense. And we're trying to get an understanding of that today on Fed Access. We'll be right back. We're going to continue this conversation in the last segment and kind of go a little bit deeper in terms of where some other things in terms of force structure versus modernization and other areas when we come back. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch from Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we have been talking about the defense budget. We're talking about actually where things are going, not necessarily for 2016, but we're talking about 2017. Where are going to be the seven areas in which, you know, the defense dollars are going? We're talking about a report from the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment about the seven areas to watch in the FY17 defense budget. We're talking to the author of this report, Catherine Blakely, and she's a research fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment. You can find this at csbaonline.org. Is that right, Catherine?
That sure is.
All right, csbaonline.org. I want to make sure people got that. The report is on the front page right now, so you can go in, download it, and see what's going on. We're not going to get to all seven today, but you can read all seven when you download the report. Catherine, you know, when we look at this piece right here and we talk about the future of defense spending, what are we seeing in terms of the future?
Yeah. And one of the things that your listeners might have heard of in context of the defense budget that's gotten a lot of press and a lot of play this year so far is the third offset strategy. You know, it's kind of a catchy title. Well, catchy in terms of defense spending, so it may not be kind of the title of a blockbuster.
Right. We're not going to see it on the movies in the summer, but it's on this piece.
Now in high def. Now in
exactly right.
The third offset strategy.
That's right.
But this really focuses and frames and informs a lot of the defense spending, and it is what is linking kind of our current programs that we have now, programs that we're going to be investing in the next few years, with meeting these full-spectrum, potentially high-end peer or near-peer conflicts in the future. It's basically our investments to bridge from the force we have now to the force we might have in the future.
So this third offset strategy and looking at it and kind of investing in it, and I'm reading through the report right now where it says, you know, likely to be small, maybe about $1 billion, but these pieces really kind of, you know, have these promising approaches to be identified. So when we look at this third offset strategy, you know, in this kind of budgetary environment, are these new technologies? Are these kind of, you know, things that say, listen, we got to look into space, we got to look into these areas? What kind of comes out of that?
Yeah, so this is a mix of old and new investments. You know, a lot of it is in the classified realm.
Okay.
But things that really enhance the advantages we have now and build on them for the future. So one real priority area for the department is undersea. We're amazing at submarines, best in the world at submarines. How can we maintain that advantage and build on that for the future to make it clear to any potential adversary that to try to match us, to try to challenge us in general, we have this really resilient capability in this realm, and it's just going to be you know, a fight they're not going to be able to win, so you're not going to want to get in that scrap.
Sure. The deterrence, I mean, we used to have the dynamics with the nuclear warheads, the deterrence strategy, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to get into anything with us because we will basically scorch earth you.
Yeah, and that's where a lot of the conversations in the department have gone, is to what capabilities are we investing in and what capabilities do we want to have it be known that we are investing in and focusing to cause people who might potentially want to be our adversaries to kind of think twice. So you really have this resurgence of deterrence theory in a way that you haven't seen in recent years. And that's part of the shift we were talking about earlier, from kind of our ground wars in the Middle East engagements to thinking about what a peer or near-peer competition could look like.
You know, I'm looking at the dynamics and I'm thinking about kind of the drones. You know, they're talking about, you know, semi-autonomous weapon systems, or, you know, the kind of UAVs. And we've also, you know, DARPA has been investing in robotics a lot more and all the other kind of pieces. So people are thinking about this Terminator dynamic. Are we going to see more dollars invested in those kind of things to kind of say, we don't necessarily have as many people, but we've got this force that we can send out, you know, that, you know, maybe a couple people can run, but it's a force multiplier.
Yeah, and I wouldn't necessarily put it as a people versus technology, because
Okay. Obviously
people and technology nearly need to work hand in hand together. But that's where you see things like what Secretary Carter talked about in his preview of the budget last week, with drones that you can throw out of a plane going at nearly the speed of sound that can all swarm together and fly together. And it does sound like something that's very sci-fi, and this is something that he revealed only last week, and so everyone's kind of trying to figure out, wow, you know, this sounds like a really cool capability. You can see how that would give you a lot of options that you didn't necessarily have before.
Right.
And other things that he talked about, like enhancements to our missile capability to enhance range, to enhance the ability to hit things from far away or hit things on sea where previously this missile was only hitting things on land. Things that really do a lot of bang for the buck.
So we really are kind of talking about the kind of the sci-fi dynamic, whether it be space or whether it be, you know, these, you know, programs that are run by humans, but like you said, you know, can swarm or can maybe sneak into certain things or penetrate certain things or things like that.
Yeah, and not all of it is on the really on the sci-fi flash whiz bang, but a lot of it is. And a lot of it is just maintaining the things that we are already really good at.
Right, right, right. We've been talking to Catherine Blakely. She's a research fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment. You can find them at CSBA online. We have been talking about the report, which is really kind of focused in on the future and also about what's happening in 2017 in terms of defense spending and priorities. It's called The Seven Areas to Watch in the FY17 Defense Budget. You can find that on CSBAonline.org. You can download it, read through it. Great report. I think also, Catherine, your presentation is on there. The video and everything else is on there as well, right?
It is.
So they
can watch it as if you had been there.
That's right. You can actually see Catherine presenting and everything else. And we definitely are going to try to have you back at some point in time, Catherine, because you really broke down and gave some insight on what's going on. But we appreciate you really kind of opening people's eyes about where things are headed in the future. Thank you so much for being on Fed Access.
You're so welcome. Glad to demystify things.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.